ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. This week kicks off an unexpected two-part episode devoted to the first three Frankenstein features. Me and guest Todd Liebenau will start things off by looking at the first two passes on Mary Shelley's infamous creation with the James Whale-directed Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. We wouldn't have the film series if Mary Shelley hadn't written her novel Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus in 1818. Shelley herself was just 18 when she started writing the horrific story of Dr. Victor Frankenstein and the dead man he resurrects. History says the story came during a dark and stormy night, when Shelley and her husband spent a weekend with Lord Byron, to be a fly on that wall. The first filmed iteration of Shelley's novel was a 16-minute short directed by J. Cyril Dawson and put out by the Edison Company in 1910. The short plays down the horrific elements in favor of, quote, the mystic and psychological problems of the story. That sounds about as entertaining as it's written. 21 years would pass before Shelley's work received its major Hollywood debut.
When this dead hand moves, the monster created by a man they called Mad is turned loose to strike terror into the hearts of men. To shock women into uncontrolled hysteria.
Elizabeth!
To prey upon the innocence of children. This is the story you've heard about, talked about. The spine-tingling, blood-chilling story that stunned your emotions. Frankenstein.
James Whale's 1931 rendition of Frankenstein is what audiences commonly consider their Frankenstein. Colin Clive plays the scientist. Unlike in Shelley's novel where he's Victor Frankenstein, he is Henry Frankenstein. Victor becomes his best friend, who reanimates a corpse played by the legendary Boris Karloff. Frankenstein was another much-needed jolt, pun intended, for Universal Studios, who, after losing nearly $2 million the year before, found success with their first horror feature, Dracula, leading them to create a pantheon of creature features. Bela Lugosi, who had played Dracula, had hoped to play Dr. Frankenstein due to his success with the previous film, but it wouldn't be until the third film, 1939's Son of Frankenstein, that Lugosi would play an actual character in the feature, though not the doctor himself. Opening in December of 1931, Frankenstein garnered $53,000 in just 1 week. It was a critical and commercial hit, and started a legacy that's endured to this day.
Bring it to Cosmic Diffuser! Remove the diffuser beds. She's alive! Alive!
The Bride of Frankenstein.
As soon as Frankenstein hit theaters, Universal was contemplating a sequel, which forced them to re-edit the ending of the original Frankenstein to allow Henry Frankenstein, who was supposed to die, to survive his trip to the windmill. Whale was hesitant to revisit the character, but after his success with The Invisible Man, Universal offered him an opportunity to direct a film he wanted to make, One More River, in exchange for producing the sequel. James Whale, who believed the sequel wouldn't top the original, decided to go bigger and campier with Bride of Frankenstein. Bride follows Henry Frankenstein once again, who has put aside all notions of his past. Unfortunately, a shadowy figure known as Dr. Pretorius, played by Ernest Thesiger, demands Henry help him create a mate for the creature, once again played by Karloff.
And? Friend?
One immediate difference between the first two films is that code approval certificate that opens Bride of Frankenstein. In the 3 short years between features, the Hollywood production code took effect, leaving directors scrambling to present their visions within the confines of Hollywood propriety, which Bride of Frankenstein has a lot of subtext worth mining. The Hays Office's biggest issues with the film were against the movie's proclamations of playing God, and Elsa Lanchester, during her portrayal of Mary Shelley, having some prominent decotage in the prologue. Other changes included the swapping of Elizabeths, Mae Clark, since the first film, had been in a terrible car crash, but had survived, and was replaced by Valerie Hobson. You also got a less gaunt Boris Karloff. Because the monster speaks in this film, Karloff's dental plate, which he'd removed in the first film to give him that sunken look, couldn't be taken out, so his face looks fuller and rounder in this feature. Upon release, the film made $950,000 profit for Universal, which amounts to about $13,000 today, and was lauded, though not as universally, as its predecessor, despite, in today's circles, being considered the superior film. Like the original Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein is part of the National Film Registry of Historic Films. Today, I'm talking with Todd Liebenau, my podcast co-host, on a show that obviously isn't this one. Todd, how are you?
Doing pretty good.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
As Christian said, my name is Todd, and I have several different things that I'm involved with out there. The primary one is a blog called Forgotten Films, where I review and discuss the movies that time forgot. So movies that generally aren't talked about much anymore. I have a podcast that's associated with that called the Forgotten Filmcast. Christian's been on it several times. So that's kind of my main thing. But then, as Christian said, I also host a podcast with her called Walt Sent Me, where we talk all about Disney movies. And we talk about Disney in the broad sense, basically, when it comes to their cinematic footprint. So on one episode, we might be talking about one of the animated features. Like recently, we did an episode on The Rescuers. But then we might also talk about something from one of their other many companies, like we've done shows on Armageddon, and we've done shows on Kevin Smith's Clerks, because all of those things got released under the Disney umbrella at one point or another. Falling right in with both of our love of classic films, one of the things we do feature on each episode of that show is we talk about one of Disney's classic animated shorts. Silly Symphonies, old Mickey Mouse stuff, whatever we happen to decide to talk about there. So those are kind of the main things. I do also write for Channel Superhero, doing reviews of old TV shows like the old Batman series, things like that. So I'm involved in lots of stuff.
And you're also a puppeteer.
I am a puppeteer, yes. That's my profession. And actually, just last night, I was at a gathering talking to someone, and I always love when I get reactions out of people when they ask casually, well, what do you do for a living? And I say, well, I'm a puppeteer. And usually they say, I've never met a puppeteer before. So that's always a lot of fun.
I can only imagine what the Frankenstein series would look like with puppetry.
Well, yeah, we did see Dracula, didn't we, on Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Todd, how did you first come to the Frankenstein series? Did any of it start with Shelley's text, or was it just diving into the films.
Well, I'm a bad reader. I like reading from time to time, but I am not good at keeping up with it. I'm a very slow reader, and so movies are always my main thing. And I don't know that I ever really sat down and watched the film completely till probably I was in college. Probably my first exposure to the cinematic Frankenstein was probably Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, because that I kind of grew up with the classic comedy stuff like Abbott and Costello and the Three Stooges and the Marx Brothers and things like that. So that was probably my first look at Frankenstein on screen. But then when I started to take movies a little bit more seriously, Frankenstein was definitely one of those ones that's like, well, you got to hit it at some point. It's just so iconic and, you know, really defined what Universal Studios was during this time period, because as I'm sure you're well aware, you know, the different studios during the classic era were known for different types of films. You know, MGM was big musicals and Warner Brothers was crime films. Well, Universal in this period, their big cash cow was horror. And Frankenstein is one of the big ones you got to hit on if you're talking about Universal in the 30s.
As an English major, my Frankenstein education did start with Shelley's text. I read it, I think, a lot earlier in maybe middle school, and I didn't really get it until I read it in college and started to take it apart. And let's just say, if we're clutching our pearls over the pre-code, post-code of Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, that's nothing compared to some of the subtextual analysis that you can get from reading the book. That's just an incentive. I would say everybody read the book, because you're going to notice a lot more there. But for me, I think the first time I saw the Frankenstein films was probably, I think it wasn't until Bride of Frankenstein that I really started to appreciate what James Whale was doing as a director in terms of creating a character and going for kind of camp, which you don't really see. I think the first Frankenstein is more of kind of a journeyman's type of film, where Whale wasn't really doing what he wanted to do, and it wasn't until the second film that the James Whaleyness, a word, comes out. For me, I've kind of watched the series in a hodgepodge of ways. So this last week, I just finally saw Son of Frankenstein, but I've seen Bride first, so I kind of see them out of order. So this episode, we're talking about 31's Frankenstein and then 35's Bride of Frankenstein. What do you think of the first two features, Todd?
Both are excellent films, and I often go back and forth over which one I like better. It's kind of like when we did our Walt Sent Me series on the Toy Story movies, and we're going, well, which is the best movie? I kind of feel the same way about Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. They're both so good. I think you're right that Bride of Frankenstein probably is where James Whale got to put a little bit more of his touch into it. I think Bride of Frankenstein probably goes a little bit deeper, and I would say is probably just slightly the better film. But I find both of them just to be incredibly intriguing, you know, not just in terms of our definition of a horror movie. I mean, this is really the beginnings of what would come to be known as a horror movie for the next several decades. Just the look of it, you know, really establishing what that Universal style was going to be. There's just a lot of great character development in both of these films, between Colin Clive as Frankenstein himself, Boris Karloff as the monster. I love some of the supporting players in these. I mean, Dwight Frye always kind of steals the show for me in both of these films. And of course, I love his Renfield in Dracula. They're just so rich. I mean, I guess these are just classic cases where, you know, people that write off classic films, these are the ones that are must-sees for me, because there's just so much richness in both of these first two Frankenstein films that they're just essential viewing, in my opinion.
Well, we're going to talk about the trajectory of how the films change and how the acting changes as we get into this, but you can really see in just how a few short years acting and cinematography and set design change.
Oh, absolutely,
and
yeah.
I watched Bride first, and then I went back and rewatched Frankenstein. I've seen Bride probably more than I've seen Frankenstein, and I would say that Bride of Frankenstein is the superior film.
Like I said, I think I am just slightly there on it. I mean, they're really kind of on a level playing field to me. Bride of Frankenstein, it does definitely have some of, like you're saying, the campier element that comes into play with it. The scene that jumps out for me with that is the moment where Pretorius brings out all his little people in the jars.
One of whom is Charles Lawton, yeah, who is Elsa Lanchester's husband.
Yeah. The scene just seems totally out of left field compared to what we've seen in the previous film. But I the bits of campiness that come in the second film add a real charm to it. There's so many moments of Bride that I think are some of the most iconic of the Universal series of horror in general. Probably the sequence involving the monster and the blind man is probably my favorite sequence in all of the Universal monster movies.
Yeah, I think Bride has, as I mentioned, it has that James Whale touch to it because he didn't believe that the sequel was going to top the original. I think the original film is more firmly a horror feature because Frankenstein's monster, I'm going to try very hard to be correct.
Right. Frankenstein is the doctor. And,
exactly.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Frankenstein's monster, Karloff took his dental plate out, so he's got that gaunt, drawn look. He doesn't speak. There's really no, aside from the scene with Maria, which ends up going south very quickly, there's really no serious attempts at humanizing.
Well, yeah, that's the big thing. I think that the monster comes across as much more human in the second film. And
very much so.
The blind man sequence is a big part of that. I think there's some other moments in there. And yes, just the look of the monster in general. He just, his face seems much more human, much more tender than in the first film. He literally looks like a corpse. You get a much stronger human angle in the second film, for sure.
The sets, I think, in the second one are more grandiose. You have that crypt. You have the basement element of the windmill. You have all these different locales, whereas the 31 version, the sets don't look as grand, which we'll see again in 39 with Sun, when the sets kind of return to that flat,
right,
painted German expressionist type of look.
Well, so, and I think Whale may have even been maybe feeling his way a little bit in just how to photograph the sets in the first film, because it's one of his first films, isn't it?
He had done, I think, The Old Dark House before this.
Yeah. So I think he gets a lot more creative just with the use of the camera in the second film.
Let's talk about Frankenstein's monster, in at least the first two, Karloff's performance. We've touched on the fact that he's definitely looks different. He's got rounder cheeks in the second film. He's more human in the second film. Because, again, that blind man sequence is really, really great. Although, I think Young Frankenstein kind of ruined it after seeing that film. But you really get this idea of what makes a human a human. He wants companionship. He wants someone to love him, which very much ties into Shelley's original novel, which deals with, as Victor, or Henry in the movie, becomes more isolated, the creature wants more human connection. And you could also go along with the fact that Frankenstein, as a text, at least in the novel, not in the movies, plays kind of like a parental allegory with Victor as the absentee dad having his kid, quote-unquote, hound him, which, again, they touch on a little bit in the third film. So I like the second film more just for how it looks at what makes humanity what it is.
It's interesting. You think about kind of the theme of the second film, or at least what they market. You know, the whole idea is the monster demands a mate. And really, it's not so much that. I don't know that the monster even really has an understanding of the concept of a mate in this.
Pretorius is kind of leading the brigade on that more than the creature.
Right. The monster is just looking for a friend. And that's just, I think that's such an intriguing concept in this. You know, just the idea of he's just this tortured soul who just needs a buddy, you know. And I think, you know, even as you get to the third film, you start to see it's almost like the monster has kind of given up on that concept. And now he's just the puppet of the doctor and the assistant, as we'll see in the third film.
I'm not too keen, or at least I'm not understanding whether it's progressive or not, that we're creating a woman. Pretty weird science. We're creating a woman out of dead parts. James Whale said that he never considered it, but there was talk. And I think it's been a long time since I've read the book, so please don't send me any angry emails. But the concept of Elizabeth being the one whose heart is taken and utilized for the bride.
Right. And actually, I want to say there are some other films that do use that concept. As a matter of fact, just recently I watched Roger Corman's last directorial effort, Frankenstein Unbound. And if I remember correctly, they do use Elizabeth as the, shall we say, the source of material for the female creature.
You have to love how two movies deal with somebody screwing up where they get body parts. Because the first movie, we get the wrong brain. Second movie, we take the wrong heart. They just need a better shopping list, I think.
Though they do come out with Elsa Lanchester in the end, which I can't argue with that. I mean, it's amazing how such a short performance is just so engrossing. Every time I watch Bride of Frankenstein, I'm just waiting and waiting for that last 10 minutes of the film. And even last night, as I was rewatching it again, I found myself rewinding and freeze framing, just watching her expressions and her movements. I love the way that she moves her head around like a bird, you know, and the hissing moment is so haunting. I love it.
Elsa Lanchester is really kind of the unsung heroine of the second film. She starts us off as Mary Shelley in the prologue, and the film's use of prologues we'll touch on in a second, but we're introduced to her in this nice, clean, proper Victorian outfit, hanging out with her husband and Lord Byron, which, considering they're sitting around with clothes on, is immediately fake, because Lord Byron would have not condoned any of that, I'm sure. But, you know, she starts off as this very prim, proper, domesticated bride.
I would say, though, with a bit of a sinister edge to her.
I was going to say, who has this dark, who's harboring kind of these dark desires, which is what James Whale was looking for. He wanted to show how a dark imagination can manifest. She finally returns as the bride. Yeah, she's kind of reduced to this feral, the cat imagery is just funny, and the bird, kind of taking those different animalistic elements that have come to define women and playing on them.
Yeah, it's a great interpretation, and she just steals the show. Yeah,
this is the first movie I can recall that has literally the world's worst rejection. Because this poor guy thinks that he's getting a lady, they're going to have a great time, and she's just not having it. She's not.
Every guy's experienced that feeling at some point.
Not only do we have Elsa Lanchester in this, but we have Ernest Thesiger, who plays Dr. Pretorius, who I think is fantastic. He had played in James Whale's Old Dark House before, which, if you haven't seen The Old Dark House, you should definitely watch it, because it plays on a lot of the same things that Whale touches on here. It's got a very, very macabre story that alludes to incest and all sorts of other weird stuff. Here is Pretorius. Ernest Thesiger just kind of goes for full-on flamboyance.
Pretorius is such an interesting character. Every time I watch the movie, I'm never exactly sure how to read him, because there's certain things about him that are kind of the standard mad scientist, and certainly things that we've seen over the years drawing from his performance there. And his look is just so unique. As I was watching the movie again last night, I kept looking and going, that nose does not happen naturally. How on earth did he get that nose? There's this edge to his performance that some people over the years have said has this flamboyancy, is this Whale trying to inject a bit of a homosexual theme into the film. I mean, it's no secret that James Whale was an out homosexual in Hollywood in the 1930s and was fine with that. And there's that great movie Gods and Monsters that goes into that whole thing. But it's interesting to read different things about, you know, the interpretation of Pretorius, because there's some people that say, oh, that's not it at all. And there's others that hold fast to the theories on that. You know, and I try not to put too much meaning behind things, not to interpret too much, but there's certainly that edge to it, you know.
Well, you are certainly on the right show, because you've listened, not an episode goes by that I don't bring up homoeroticism in a movie. But yeah, you do have Pretorius interrupting Frankenstein's wedding with this demand that they are going to create life,
right?
And not him and his bride. She's kind of left alone, and they become kind of the same-sex parents, quote-unquote, of this monster. You really have to read into it, I think, which is probably the problem for me as somebody who spent her academic career reading into things. Ernest Essinger is just going all over with this. He's taking his wine and his dinner at the crypt amongst the dead. He's got these little, you know, people in jars, one of whom is Henry VIII, who was kind of this known glutton of food and women and sex and children. And he's just got all these little moments that lie within him wanting to be proclaimed as a god.
Right. Well, even just the way that he does that introduction, you know, when the bride is finally revealed and he goes, "The Bride of Frankenstein," you know, and it's
where you think they get like the introduction to Svengoolie or something.
Yeah, yeah,
like that.
Yeah, it's so theatrical and such.
I love his theatricality. Who I don't like in Bride is Una O'Connor.
I knew you were going to say that. Because we've talked about this before. I have a bit of a soft spot for her. She's also in The Wolfman and I enjoy her in that. But I know from some of our previous discussions that she just is like nails on a chalkboard to you.
She's so shrill and she's so over the top, and really I don't see her character possessing any purpose.
Well, I agree with you on that. Yes, I mean, if she does have any purpose, it wasn't realized until Mel Brooks did Frau Brücker in Young Frankenstein. But I don't know, I think she's an element that adds a bit more of that campiness that we were talking about that Bride has that the original does not.
If I was going to recommend an Una O'Connor film, I would say watch Christmas in Connecticut, because she's got a great subplot with S.Z. Cuddlesackle, who is really, really great. But yeah, I do not care for her at all in this. Well, let's talk about some other differences between the first and the second film. This was the first big sequel that I, at least I can recall, from 3 years between 31 to 35. And what's great for me to watch, and I would love to hear from somebody who had actually maybe seen both films in their original state, is what that means to an audience. Because in 31, 35, you don't have any way to rewatch a movie.
Right. I was thinking about that as I was rewatching Bride last night, because I don't know that I had ever watched them all in close succession like I just did. And going, oh, yeah, they're not really making any bones about the fact that it's a completely different woman playing Elizabeth. I mean, her hair color changes completely. And you've got a different father for Maria, who bites the dust at the beginning of Bride. But even elements of the sets and the look of things is quite a bit different between the two films. It would have been 4 years or so between people. They wouldn't have been rewatching it on video every week and going, oh, well, that's different.
Yeah, and I think that really is what was to the film's benefit, because for a film class, we watched them back to back, and my teacher had to tell us, you know, you need to remember there's 4 years that has passed in between these movies, but the second film starts immediately after the first film, and Whale had no way of knowing, well, he knew that audiences weren't going to be able to recall much aside from the basic structure of the movie from 31. So it didn't really matter that he replaced Mae Clark with Valerie Hobson, or that Baron Frankenstein, or that the villagers are different. I think that that's really interesting to consider, how audiences had to rely on what they were presented. If you did remember something different, the movie was just going to say, you know, it doesn't matter because nobody else remembers.
Right, exactly.
This one also has the seal from the code, because the code had gone into effect in the 3 years between films. The first film is pre-code, but I don't necessarily get kind of what pre-code was known for at the time.
Yeah.
Which is usually the salacious sex and drug themes and stuff like that. Which, in 31, though, the concept of reanimating a body and playing God was considered sacrilegious.
Yeah.
So it was conforming to what Hayes thought the code needed to fix.
Well, and I would say that the second film is maybe even more in fitting with what I would usually associate with the traits of pre-code, because it does have that deeper subtext to it. It's got a higher body count than the first film does. I think there's just a bit more shocking moments in the second film. Certainly, I understand where people were skittish about the first. I rewatched the first film with my 17-year-old daughter. And it was her first time seeing it. And I was, you know, trying to tell her how this stuff was just the most shocking thing that people had ever seen at this point. And she just couldn't believe it. The one scene that really kind of had her going, oh, are they going to go there? Is, of course, the Maria scene, which, you know, was cut out of a lot of versions. I mean, I can remember when I was in high school in the 80s and they finally found a print of the movie that had that in there and they were able to put it back in the film. It had been lost for decades. And it's interesting because that moment, I forget how they've actually had it edited before, but you have the kind of lead up to the sequence, you know, the monster encounters the child. And then the next thing we see is the father carrying her dead body, which is much more shocking in the edited version than what we actually have in the full version of the film.
The body count tends to dwindle as the code takes effect, as the 30s segue into the 1940s. But Maria's death is the most shocking element, I think, of all three of the movies we're talking about, because it starts out so innocuous. She's the little girl with the lamb, and her dad says he's going to be back soon. There's no score, so we're not told that this is anything to be fearful of. And honestly, it's the one humanizing moment, I think, that the monster gets in the first film.
Exactly.
Because he's unaware of what he's doing.
Yeah, and it's a great scene for Karloff as an actor, too, just to see the transition the character goes through, you know, as he's playing very innocently with her, and then the moment he realizes the mistake that he's made and such.
The fact that he realizes is what's so subtle about it, is that he does realize he's done something that he can't take back, but he's not really sure what it is.
Yeah, you're right. It is the strongest moment of humanity for the monster. There's a few others in the first film. I think actually one of the most iconic moments for me in the first film is the scene where he's seated in the chair and Frankenstein opens up a window and allows the sunlight in. And the creature experiences the sunlight for the first moment there. And he stands up and he raises his arms almost in this, you know, like he's praise type pose. And you know, we haven't talked about the religious angle of these movies at all, but, you know, there is that whole concept of Frankenstein playing God and all this. And I think that's a unique moment in this film, because it's like where the monster, you know, like I said, he's got his arms raised. It's like this, you know, position of worship, of praise and such. I think that's part of where Dr. Frankenstein's attitude towards his creation changes, because he's got that line earlier where he talks about, I know what it feels like to be God. And here's this moment where it's almost like the monster is recognizing a different God. And then suddenly we see Frankenstein's attitude towards his creation start to change. So that's another moment that I think, unique little bit of humanity that Karloff puts into the character.
And I love how we have no problem with the father parading Maria's dead body down the street.
Well, like I said, that image in itself is just much more shocking than what we
get. And I think that plays into the decision of the code, at least for me, noticing how it's pre-code, because I don't think you would get that in 35.
Yeah.
But the body count, I think, does dwindle. And by the time we get to Sun, we'll talk about how a lot of the deaths are off camera or in shadows. They're not at all shown in any type of overt element. Let's talk about religion very briefly, the first two movies, because I think what I notice is that Frankenstein as the mad scientist has this abrupt 360 between the first and the second film. He's very much consumed in the first movie with being this godlike figure. The whole It's Alive moment, which is legendary, and Colin Clive captures that hysteria so well, it was enough for James Whale to bring him back for the second movie, even though by that point he was a drop-dead alcoholic, which I think helped his performance.
I was going to say, that shows a bit.
But the second movie, a lot of what was critiqued from the code's perspective in the second film was creating the creature as a Christ figure. When he's trotted out to the windmill in that Christ pose, the idea that he is Henry's kind of only begotten son, forced to die for the villagers to have some type of catharsis. You could easily do, I think, a dissertation about how the Frankenstein movies, especially Bride, works as, in turning the creature into a Christ figure.
Well, and even just the fact that he has this iconic moment with a blind man. And I mean, he doesn't heal the blind man, obviously, but he does in a way, because the blind man is lonely. The blind man has had no hope. He's sitting there in this cabin out in the woods and nobody ever comes, and now somebody has come, and it's not a literal healing, but it is a bit of a healing moment.
Which, in the book, if memory serves, there is a blind man, but he has a family, and or the creature essentially kind of hangs out at the house because the blind man can't see him when the family leaves, and when they come back, he essentially watches them interact, and that's how he learns what interaction looks like, and I think he also learns how to read in that same period of time. For the creature in the novel, that man and his family teaches him what being a human is and educates him about tradition and domesticity.
Speaking of that, what's your take on the fact that because of that interaction, we now have a monster who speaks in the second film?
Karloff wasn't too keen on the speaking part. And I have to say, when we talk about the third one, that's all but eliminated,
right?
Mostly. In the grand context of the three we're talking about, it's a waste. In the context of the second film, immediately goes from rudimentary to, like, eloquent.
Yeah.
By the end, you know, with the whole we belong dead type of thing. I would have enjoyed had they maintained that he was learning throughout and not that it becomes this grand revelation where all of a sudden he can talk in Karloff's, you know, prim English accent.
Yeah, he gets a bit from the blind man, he gets a bit more from Pretorius, and then, yeah, he's, like, delivering speeches at the end.
I do want to touch on the focus, or maybe lack thereof, on the creature as the first two films kind of progress, because the first film we've kind of mentioned that the creature is this hulking behemoth, and the second one, that desire for companionship becomes untenable for him. And it's ironic that he is so desperate for a companion, and Henry can't get away from Elizabeth quick enough. Poor Mae Clark in the first film, Valerie Hobson in the second film. She's got a husband who just don't want to hang out with her. And the first film, there's kind of allusions to a rival, Victor.
Right.
I don't know why we couldn't have Victor being his character, but Victor becomes the friend. In the second film, he's gone. So we don't really know what we want to say about the actual matrimonial union. The only marriage in the movie is between Henry and Elizabeth.
One of the things that sounded like you were starting to allude towards there is, I think, a theme that runs throughout all these films is, who is the real monster? I mean, because I think that in all three of the first three Frankenstein films, the character we call the monster is not the monster of each of these films. I would say that it's Henry in the first film. I would say it's Pretorius in the second film. We'll get to the third film eventually here, but it does kind of play with that concept of, you know, what makes a monster, so to speak.
The last point I have is the changes between the novel and the films, which I'll just touch on a couple of them. The fact that the novel really plays on Victor and the creature having this back and forth. I mean, the creature kind of haunts him for several years. There's really no haunting, I think, in this movie. Henry in the second film just kind of gets drawn in by Pretorius, and he's seemingly given up all claims of wanting to create anything. Would you have preferred the creature to be a bit more of an active participant in his own quest for his dream?
I would say so. I do think there is a little bit of an element in the second film of just the creature being a haunting presence to Henry. And like the scene where he first sees the monster and realizes that the monster is still alive. The way the first film is structured, the monster is created, and then the monster gets out and terrorizes. You know, there's not that much of an opportunity for Henry to really realize the error of his ways. For two films that each of them, the first one's an hour and 10, the second one's an hour and 15, they're incredibly deep little films. And
they really are. It's, I think, why I enjoy classic films, particularly the earlier you get in the era, because you can do a lot in 75 minutes that I think a lot of movies today don't do in 2 hours and 20.
Yeah.
Let me know what you think about the Frankenstein series, specifically Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I'll read them on the next episode. I'm not going to say goodbye to Todd, though, because he is going to be back to talk with us about Son of Frankenstein. So we'll give him a fitting send-off when we get to that film. That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you listen via iTunes, please feel free to leave a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official site where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also now on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Next time, I'll be talking with another guest about TCM Star of the Month, Natalie Wood, and her film Splendor in the Grass. Until next time, have a safe and spooky Halloween.